I'm very pleased to welcome to Fremantle Shipping News, Anya Brock. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, here we are, Anya, in the Pierce Art Space studio that you had for many years. It's a lovely, inviting place to be. How did you discover it?
Yeah, I had moved back from London in around 2010, 2011. I was working out of the places that I was staying in. I lived in a granny flat for a while, and I always kind of had my studio on top of me. And I think around 2012, I had started painting full time, and I had the money, and I needed to have my workspace separate from my home space. And I was just looking for studio space around Fremantle, and somehow, I don't even know, I must have been through word of mouth from someone saying, have you checked out PSAS? And Tom Mueller was the studio manager then, has been, he's only just finished recently. So I had a chat to him, and amazingly, there was quite a few spaces available then. Now there's like a wait list for this place, you know, which is long and, you know, hard to get into. So then I found this space and moved straight in and started packing it full of my stuff, as you can see.
You've done very well. If success is the
packedness. I occasionally do a big clean out and try and get rid of as much stuff as possible, but then I'm like, great, I've got space, quick, get some more stuff in.
Now, You not only have your studio here, but I think you live in Fremantle as well.
Yeah, I live in South Freo.
And you grew up in the general environment of Fremantle, did you?
Well, I grew up in Applecross, well, Alfred Cove.
Yes.
Went to Applecross High, but I always found myself, you know, when I was 14, on a bus to Fremantle. Always I'd just find myself in Freo.
Yes.
Which, you know, I was always op shopping or buying stuff from mills. So it was kind of that lifestyle I was naturally drawn to. And then I lived in Scarborough for a while and then went to London for 18 months, 2 years. And then as soon as I came back, it was like I lived with my mum and dad for 6 months when I came back. But after that, I was like, I just have to be in Freo. That's just where I am.
Yeah.
And then I moved to Sydney for 3 years. And then my partner was in Melbourne. We, you know, lived between Melbourne and Sydney, and then Sydney, and kind of just knew that we'd come back and buy a house in Freo.
Well,
South Freo.
The people who start listening to this podcast will also have seen some of the images of your recent paintings, and also some of the images of what is going to be hanging in the gallery over the road, the white space, which you're opening on Saturday night.
Yeah.
And what's the name of that exhibition?
It's called Rush, Rush, Gone.
Rush, Rush, Gone. Is there a couple of commas in there somewhere?
No, just all one word, bang. I mean, all one sentence, it's all joined. It's supposed to be, it's not supposed to feel spacious in that there's pauses. It's like Rush, Rush, Gone.
Well, I like it, particularly when you said it just like that. And I imagine hours and hours and hours and hours of thinking have gone into getting the name.
Yeah, no, I mean, it was one of the painting titles. So often it's my painting titles that have all of that conceptual wealth and depth in them. And this, I was trying to come up with the name for this show, and it is about motherhood. I, you know, thought about motherhood, but it felt too literal. And then this
sounded like too much
punchy.
A motherhood statement, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, it is about motherhood, but we didn't want to be too in your face with that, because that can be either divisive in that some people don't relate to it, and then other people maybe just want to escape from it, don't want to see a whole show about it. But
well, we'll get back
to
that in a minute. I'm very interested to know how you got to here. You've told us a little of your biographical story. Did you take part in, I think Applecross High used to have a special art program.
Yeah, I did special art there.
Ah.
Yeah.
So what made you want to get into that program? Did you have parents who encouraged you to do these things earlier?
Yeah, I mean, my dad was always really good at drawing, and my mum put us in after school art classes when we were in primary school. And I guess my sister and I were always just making things. Mum and dad fixed chairs, or used to, you know, they have a business called Chair Repair, and we would always be at the workshop after school making tiny chairs and upholstering things. And, you know, at home we'd get the old rattan that had been cut out of the rattan, you know, chairs, and we'd be weaving. So there was always an element of tactility and creativity in our childhood. And then I guess, yeah, I mean, we were going to Applecross anyway, and it wasn't even necessarily, because we were in that catchment area, it wasn't necessarily even about the art program. So it was kind of like a nice coincidence. I started in year 8, my sister started doing it when she was in year 10. I think there was deliberation in our family as to whether spending that much time on your creative units as opposed to your academic units?
Well, it is an interesting question. I suppose everyone's had to deal with it as kids at that age trying to make some career choices, or parents trying to guide children who have those artistic capacities. So did you have to make some very explicit decision? Did you decide this is what I'm going to do with my life?
Yeah, I mean, from what I don't remember, but I apparently stuck my foot down and said, I want to do it from year eight. I want to do it because I guess, I mean, I don't remember that. I think my sister remembers that because she started doing it when she was in year 10 and she always wanted to, I think, explore that program earlier. But I think I went into, after doing special art, I went into fashion and textile design at TAFE.
So that was the next move out of high school.
Yeah, and I think because, weirdly, my parents were like, there was still, I think, definitely that opinion of artists don't make money. And there was the opinion of like, oh, well, she wants to be a fashion designer, she'll make money in that. Like, that's a lucrative industry, which is kind of not, you know,
it may work, but there's lots of...
It did, for a long time, it was lucrative for me.
Lots of fashion cuttings lying on floors everywhere, I imagine.
That industry has changed dramatically in the last kind of 10, 15 years, so...
So you went to TAFE to do that.
Yeah.
And I can see how that sort of had the craft background that you're describing from your parents, plus this art experience that you've had at high school, and you're wanting to turn it into something that can be a viable career when an artist, a visual artist, painting and so on, is a much more precarious existence in prospect, one might think.
I think for a lot of people from the outside looking in, it seems maybe like an insane business model.
But you became involved in fashion design. And
yeah.
It took you places and you did things. Tell us about that part of your career.
So I think, I mean, I don't know if it's because my parents are small business owners. I started my own label at the end of second year when I was at TAFE. So I had my own label selling to about, I guess, eight or nine local stores in Subiaco's, the city, you know, Fremantle boutiques. And in that day and age, high street wasn't a big thing. You know, there wasn't Zara, there wasn't H&M, you know, that wasn't in Perth yet.
No,
so those stores were doing really well. And you could make your own. I did all the production myself. I was really good at sewing.
So you designed and fabricated and marketed it to the store.
Well, and it was kind of, you know, like everything, it's never been a big plan for me. I started making clothes for myself and my friends out of fabric that I'd found at op shops, like old batik tablecloths and things like that, and I'd make little tops. And my friends would say, you could sell that. And I don't even know how everything has always just kind of happened, which I think is the story of almost everybody's kind of pinball experience. And I pitched it to stores. Like, I don't even remember anymore. And they were like, great, we'll take 20 of those. And then I was like, great, I'll just make them and
20.
Give them to, you know, like I wasn't selling on the correct season. I would just basically say, I can have these for you in a week. And I would do I would work on my business, and then when I'd have assessments due, I'd just smash out my assessments. I never was really, I think I always felt like at TAFE, they allowed too much time on a assignment, and I used to work really well under high stress situations, and we'd have 6 weeks for a collection or whatever to be designed, and I would design three within that. You know, I just kind of, I didn't work well reworking my ideas over and over. Usually the first idea that I had was the one that was most potent, and then the feeling would pass and then I would come up with another one. So that kind of worked well.
So what was your fashion label?
Initially it was called Kin, but I didn't register that. So
there's lessons in intellectual property to be gained.
Totally. Had all of the labels and everything printed up, and then realised that was already taken. I mean, I probably just could have put a few more words afterwards and got the business registration. And then I called it Anan, which was extremely difficult for people to understand. So once again,
all right, well,
lessons.
I won't explore that. But yes, there's a lot in three or four letters.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what was the segue from fashion designing to art in a more full way?
Again, it came about quite organically. I felt quite restricted. The longer I stayed in, the longer I was with my label, I realised I had to sell on season. I had to abide by some of the rules that existed within that industry.
Can't sell bikinis in winter.
Yeah, well, you do, you know, you actually do to shops. You sell that range, you know, 9 months, a year in advance. And it was still, I mean, it's so fast now that I think it's different. But in that day and age, you did have to sell quite a while, you know, beforehand. Mm. And then I started getting external production, and then I even produced in... Did we produce in Bali? Yeah, I produced in Indonesia for a while as well. And the more it became a business, mm. and the more legitimate it became, the more I lost interest in it.
Yes.
And the more it became about making money and less about the design, you spend a tiny amount of time designing and doing all the fabrication, yeah. and then the rest of it is spent in admin and logistics, which is not where my brain sits well.
CEO having to think about a Harvard MBA or something instead of a creative force in the back room.
Yeah, and that's, you know, I later went to London and I, you know, that's why there's designers and then they have business managers. Like, it's how the industry is set up, but when you are just one person, you tend to do everything. But in that kind of a business, the actual production is so intense.
Yes.
And I would always, you know, little things like just putting together my numbers from all my orders, I would always mess it up. So by the time I got all of my production back, I'd be like, I'm three dresses short. How did that happen? I was like, I can't be trusted to do this. I need somebody else for this job to be counting, you know.
So you mentioned earlier the high street stores that came along, the Zara's and H&M and so on. Did they have an impact on the fashion industry?
Well, I wasn't really in it at that stage. I had my label for about 6 years, and towards the end of that time I was drawing and painting kind of at night or in my spare time as a creative outlet from my creative job. So in 2006, I think, maybe seven, I don't even know my timeline, maybe it was 2008, I went to London. I had got an internship with a designer over there, applied for internships with a few different designers and got them, and kind of just decided to up and leave. It was a bit of a weird thing where I was in a relationship at the time and I just kind of said, I'm out of here. I'm really sorry, but I'm going for 6 months. I think I just knew I wasn't growing anymore in that place in my life, and I felt like this was the only way to dramatically leave it.
Yes.
And move on to the next chapter. So it was something kind of internally in me, driving me to do it. And I was not listening to all of the ideas in my brain of like, what, this is an insane thing to do. You're just moving to London without any, you know, any support. I had friends over there, but it was basically like going over on my own. I mean, I was young. I was just saying to my assistant before, I would never move anywhere on my own now. Like, you know too much when you're older. It's insane.
Good point. But that comes to an end and you come back. Was that an equally dramatic decision making?
Yeah, I think I was over there in the fashion industry working for some of the biggest designers over there at the time, and I realized I didn't love it enough to work for free. Because that industry basically exists mostly off, you know, interns doing a huge amount of work. I was an intern for about 3 weeks and then I demanded to be paid, which my employer was like, who is this person? Like, what? Because I was doing the job of somebody who was formerly being paid and then they got fired and I just like slid right into her position without any pay. I was like,
You were meant to be grateful.
Yeah, but I was also a lot more qualified and I was a lot older than all the other interns there. So I think they were like, well, she's coming from a different space. And then I think over a period of time I was like, my heart's not in this anymore. And the more I painted and did some drawings, and you know, I was constantly drawing and painting around work again,
yes,
and realizing that's when I felt the happiest. And I had a full kind of identity breakdown over there, which was really important for me at that time. I guess the identity that I had constructed around being in the fashion industry,
yes,
wasn't relevant anymore, and I needed to kind of figure out who I was away from that. So I kind of stripped myself down to, and then rebuilt myself with what I believed in at the time. And then I moved back because I had nothing more. I realized I had nothing more to prove to myself.
Yes.
And so what was I doing over there when really?
Yeah.
I mean,
well, it's a lovely tale of discovery as you tell it. So you come back to painting. And what did
I did come back and try and start my label again.
Oh, you tried just starting your label.
It was one of those things I just had to learn that lesson over and over again. Because I was like, well, that's how I make money. I don't work for other people. That's not my jam.
Painting is something for dilettantes, or to keep me happy on the side.
I guess I just thought, I wasn't even trying to sell at that point. I was just painting for fun.
Yes.
And I was doing on the side. I tried to start my label up again, but all of my local production was no longer around.
Mm.
Everything was so difficult. I felt like I was literally tripping over all the time because it wasn't meant to happen, and it felt like everything was kind of working against me. And so I stood back and was like, this actually is not where I want to be. And so then I actually started working for other people. I was working at TAFE, I was lecturing at the time, and then I also was working in a fashion store, like working retail, which is outrageous for me because I'm terrible at retail.
I love being in the studio space. We've got some nice, hopefully they come through background noises to prove we're here.
Luckily there's no intermittent power tools going on.
Well, let's hope, just for a short time. But what was the thing that happened and the in a sense, the break or the thing that occurred that got you on the path to where you are now?
I think I just started painting works, putting it out on social media. Instagram and Facebook were instrumental, massive, which was, I think, a very lucky time for that to all come about because you could paint something, put it on social media, someone say, how much, I want to buy it. Great, here you go. And so it felt so easy and that was all kind of set up at the right time for that to happen. So I just started painting more, selling more, to the point where I didn't need my lecturing job at TAFE anymore and I could work full time. And I was in that, I had so much energy and I was doing yoga at 6 a.m. every day. So I was like not drinking very much, which was probably key. So I was super productive and able to, like I was just saying yes to everything, doing shows left, right and center.
So about when?
So 2012, that's sometime, when this started, I think, beginning mid 2012, I quit and I just was like, well, this is what I do now full time. And then it just gained momentum from there.
And in terms of talking about the art and not so much the business at the moment, what were you painting? And you know, how big and what did it look like?
Usually round about a metre by a metre canvases or 90 by 120. Lots of girls and budgies, they were kind of the first ones. Then birds, geometrics, I was doing a lot of symmetrical geometric work back then.
Yep.
And then animals, I guess, as well.
Yes.
So that's where that all started.
And the marketing, just to touch on that, you explained the advent of Insta. People really got into that, great for photographs.
And it wasn't monetized then.
It wasn't monetized. People say, can I buy that? Oh, what? Yes, yeah. It was just people put their photographs up.
Yeah, and there was no algorithm. You know, like it's not in the way now that if you don't pay for advertising on Facebook and Instagram, you don't show up in anybody's feeds. Back then it was literally, you know, it felt far more organic.
Yes.
And so there wasn't this thing of I need to have a full marketing plan just to be able to use Facebook and Instagram properly.
Yes.
So whereas that's now the case.
Well, I attended a webinar this morning where people are talking about the regulation of those big tech companies.
Yeah, so I saw something recently on, what was it, MailChimp maybe, that there's now data regulation.
Many to talk about it. And Facebook is saying, well, we won't provide the Australian platform if you want to regulate us. That'd be interesting, wouldn't it?
Good Lord. I mean, we just watched the Social Dilemma, which, you know, have you seen that yet?
Yes.
Yeah, just that, the one point, the fact that is not, that industry of data collection is not regulated is amazing.
It is, and no one realised just how
destructive,
how big and destructive it could be. So you are, I'm guessing, and people can look at these images that you've just described, You struck some chord. People wanted to buy these things. You had a sense of what people might want. Was it trial and error? Or?
No, I mean, again, nothing's planned. I just painted what felt, and that was the biggest lesson I learned in London about myself, is that I can't think about what other people are going to think about this or whether it's what people want.
Good.
Or it had to just be purely because that's the spontaneity of it, and spontaneity and experimental processes was at the very core of my process, and I had to keep it that way. And even now I have to be really careful not to be caught up in what sells well to then base that next step on that, because that will never work, doing what you think people will buy.
And it certainly, for most people anyway, and most artists, wouldn't be satisfied.
No, it's a vacuous practice to try and create in that way. But it's trial and error. I think people go through that, and then you realize the works, because each step of your process has to be decided by someone and something, and if it's you, it makes sense.
Yes.
Because you know your internal map. Whereas if you are basing each decision on what you think somebody else would look like, it's like writing a character for a film. You need to know the ins and out of that character so
yes.
extremely well to know what they're going to want. Otherwise, it's all these mixed messages, which
yes.
that muddies that process so much that it is not enjoyable. That's
yes.
why commissions are so difficult
yes.
to nail and to get that life and that magic in there, which I think is what people can't put their finger on why a painting works, but there's that magic.
Yes. Now, there's a point at which in your more recent career, you started painting what can be variously called very large murals on the sides of buildings mm. out on streets, or street art of a certain type. Magnificent things. Well, I walked past these colourful zebras,
mm.
or as the Americans would say, zebras, mm. In South Fremantle, which I think you did.
Yes, I did.
So how
that
did
was
that
the first one I did, actually.
That was the first, the very first.
Yeah. Once again, my friend owned Utong and Lincoln. I went to high school with her, and she was like, we want something on that wall. I saw the zebras you've been painting. I was like, great, let's do it. Didn't get council approval or anything. We just whacked it up because we knew that maybe the neighbours might have a problem with all of the
Well,
stuff.
A friend of mine had some magpies put on the side of his outside wall not long ago.
Yeah, Brenton. Was it Brenton C?
Well, of course, caused a stir.
Oh, really?
Yes, he did,
yeah.
I think. So again, it's all about art. If you paint a wall
yeah.
pink with funny stripes on it, some people won't like it, will complain.
Exactly.
You put two beautiful zebras on the side of a building and it becomes an icon.
Yeah, I know. I mean, the nature of my murals is all about scale. It has to be simple and large in scale. And that's why it works and appeals to kids, which, you know, is
Ooh, don't
worry
lovely. Just about the kids.
Yeah, I know. I think
the kids' grandparents love them too.
Yeah, bright and simple. It's a funny, and I guess that's my design training, is that it's
yes.
always
yes.
it's always about composition, and it's about a singular figure or a couple of figures on a flat surface, always on a flat background, which
yes.
has dictated my process and what goes on within that area of detail. There's lots of layering and lots of, you know,
yes.
I've got a formula that I work with so that I know how to move the parts within that formula. I don't paint scenes as such.
Let's come back to that. But presumably the zebras at Utong and Lincoln then started this mini career painting murals.
Yeah.
And
again, I'd never thought that I'd be painting.
How many have you done and where?
I think there's almost 60,
maybe
60 or 70. Yeah,
wow.
I know.
And
I
where are they to be found?
I
don't mean street by street. Are many of them in Perth?
Lots of them in Perth, some in Sydney and Melbourne. There's one in LA, a couple in LA at a school there. Where else? I think that's it.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, what I mean, it must be quite exciting. To,
yeah, the thrill is
to
great.
Set that up and see yeah. the outcome. And you're sharing it like a lot of public art these days, sculptures in malls and public places. There's one down here in Fremantle that people come across. What is it about public art and big murals like that?
We don't have creativity in our everyday life, which is insane. Our society is set up in such a strange kind of void of, you know, expression way. So of course, when there is any kind of self-expression in a public forum, people are drawn to it, I think. Creativity is enigmatic, and I think people are interested and intrigued by it.
Hmm. And sometimes, I suppose, wish perhaps they could do it?
Yeah, I mean, maybe. Some people have, yeah, interest. I think at the heart of everybody is a creative, and I think that's probably why most people have a connection to it. Some people are completely disconnected to that side of themselves, but I guess because of that, some people, it's that whole thing of continuing to nurture and keep alive your inner child, because as soon, and our society does not really encourage that, I think. We're very much, you know, processed into adults as soon as possible. But I think because we all remember painting as a kid, and most of the time whenever I'm painting murals, people will come up and talk to me about their creative practice, which is, you know, fine. The most common thing is people either say, oh, I can't draw a stick figure. I'm like, that's actually probably the only thing you can draw at this point, but like, you can. But there's there is this need to talk about their relationship to their creativity. And a lot of people say, I loved doing art in high school and that's the last time I did it.
And isn't that interesting? I've observed before talking to poets that we were all almost forced to love poetry and to write creatively, not just at primary school, through high school.
Mm.
Suddenly people leave high school.
It stops.
And it's as though you no longer have a license to do these things, that it's not something real people do, or if you're really going to have security and financial stability, you have to put all of that aside. It's for children and it's not for adults.
And a creative practice is extremely confrontational and I think involves a lot of discipline. So I think it's not for everybody anyway, but it is, you know, it is a difficult thing to keep alive. And it's easier when it's monetized for some people because there's motivation and there's a reason. And then sometimes for some people it's harder when it's monetized. So I think, there's how people feel about their own creative practice or whether they have one or not. It is about their personality and if they're a person who has the discipline to do that, or, you know, a lot of people I think do not want to put their mirror up to themselves all the time, and that's what it is. And it's hard because you do things and you're like, that is absolutely rubbish, but then you still have to go back and face it again. So it's definitely about confronting your own insecurities, and that's quite hard for a lot of people.
And then the expression that comes through art, it seems to me, can be various. You take Picasso's Guernica, or he's dealing with dark things at a dark time in Spain and the like. Then you get paintings by Georgia O'Keeffe, which perhaps are just full of spirit or whatever. I mean, what do you try to convey? Some message? Are you trying to just create a feeling? What is the purpose?
There's never the thought to how it will be perceived. It always has to just be a spontaneous thing of, I feel like I can paint this today. I have a bit of a weird disconnect with my subject matter because I am an abstract painter, but I found my way through mark making with the vehicle of figuration. So, and I guess I kind of, because I'm a business mind as well as a creative, for some reason I think, I don't know, there was this thing of like, well, I have to paint something, so I guess I'll just paint this figurative thing and I'll get to abstract within that. Whereas had I have worked on my process without putting things out a little longer, maybe I would have just become an abstract painter. So there's this thing where I don't, you know, I paint birds and I paint local flora and fauna, but I don't have a personal connection to what I paint, which I think, I don't know if people who buy the work care about that, because a lot of people do have a sentimental connection to the things that I paint, but I don't. I mean, for the girls I do, because I'm a woman. I paint the complex kind of nature of being a woman, and that's what I can relate to, whereas I don't, you know.
There's always a debate in literature, in writing, in novels, and there was that pejorative expression that may still be out there, chicks lit, as though there was only stuff that women would read and wasn't for men and written by women, although I suspect it probably wasn't just written
by
women.
Yeah, probably a lot of ghostwriters in there.
So, I mean, do you think in your experience, do women express themselves artistically in painting differently from men?
I mean, definitely, because you're painting your experience, which is always different from, I mean, it, you know, obviously that's case by case situation, but I think women are better at nurturing their creative side, which is probably, you know, controversial to say, but for what our society allows, I think you can see that. I mean, it, just going off my market is like 90% women, and any painting purchases by, most painting purchases by men, it's usually women buy on emotion and an initial reaction to the piece and an emotive reactive to the piece, where men buy on whether it's a clever and a smart financial decision. Will it appreciate? And also, yeah, like there's, I think for a lot of guys, it's like, really, you're spending that on something's gone on a war. Like, there's a real disconnect with being able to emotionally respond to artwork for men. And that is, again, a, you know, very generalized comment. There's lots of crew that are not, do not fall within that. But yeah, I think women's and men's experience is, you know, very different, but it is artist by artist as well.
Now, I think along the way between 2012 and today, you've become a mother.
Yes.
Has that affected your outlook and what you paint?
Yeah. Well, yes and no. It's that thing of I have the ability. So the experience and the joy of my work is in the process. That's why I feel like subject matter doesn't really matter.
That's interesting. When you say in the process, do you mean standing there looking at the wall and putting paint on it?
Yeah, I mean just putting a loaded paintbrush on canvas and the layering that goes into it and the fact that it is an action-reaction process. So it's, I don't know how something is going to turn out. I work with colour on a gut level. So I will hold a paint pot up and I will see if it works with those colours, and that may vary on day to day depending on how I feel that day. So it's many moving parts with a creative process, and I try not to make anything too solid in its state because I want to surprise myself. I kind of need to put myself outside of my own brain, and that's why I often will listen to podcasts or watch TV, like have TV that I know really well, television shows that I find stimulating, but I know back to front, so I don't need to see them. So I have my brain occupied so I can work purely on a gut level.
You mean you can be listening to a podcast talking about exploration and out of space while you're painting?
I don't listen to those kinds of podcasts, but
so is there a
particular, do find podcasts a little bit music, harder. Or? To it, I can't have, yeah, I need my brain entertained in a casual manner.
Yes.
I can't be thinking too much about something. So
yes.
It's often things that I've heard and are very familiar with. And often it is like just to be casually entertained while I'm working on things, because I don't need my brain for it. It's all just working on a gut level. So.
Does not the brain intersect with the gut?
I don't. If it does, it's usually that thought is not relevant. That's something that's coming in of like, will this be popular, or what? That's going to be a nightmare to store if I paint that big, or you know, things like that that are not helpful to the process of being a courageous, bold painter.
Right.
You have to absolutely eschew rationality.
Right.
Because otherwise, that's the whole problem with, I think, society is it's too rational. Everything has to make sense. And if you think about your creative process from a rational business side, because you do have to be rational in your business side of your brand, you kill a lot of great ideas because they don't make sense on a, you know, on a business level. And the whole idea of being an artist is being exciting and unpredictable and doing things that people go, that doesn't make sense, but how great that you've done it.
Well, that brings us, I think, rather
to my
nicely,
new show.
to Saturday night.
Yeah.
So people come into the White Space Gallery at 1 Pakenham Street, right next to the just about to be opened and will be opened by then, Republic of Fremantle next door.
Mm.
You'll come into the entrance of White Space, you'll be faced with some of your paintings there, and then you'll navigate a deathly staircase straight out of Dickens.
Yeah.
And you go up into a fabulous space at the top. Now, what are people going to see? What is it that you've done there, and how is it different, if it is,
well,
from what
no
you've
birds.
Done before?
Not a bird in sight.
Not a bird in sight.
Although when people see my abstraction, they often say, I can see a bird in there. I'm like, there's no birds in there, but
their brains have
if
been
you'd
trained.
Like to see that, that's
yes.
fine. So it's all mark-making, colourful mark-making, expressive work.
Now, you're going to have to explain to some people what mark-making is.
So it's so as an abstract painter, you build up a vocabulary of marks, and that's based on the type of brush you use, how wet the paint is, how diluted the paint is, what medium you're mixing with the paint to be able to set brush strokes in place, if you're watering down a layer and it's all fluid and soft underneath. So there's lots of I get lost in that process of, instead of just having a work that comes about with one or two layers, it's often pieces that are worked on, and I work on all, I worked on all of these as unstretched canvas on the floor of my studio, all with my left hand. So
is that because you're left-handed, or because you want that result?
Because I want the naivety. My right hand is far too well trained.
You've now got me wondering which shoulder Jackson Pollock threw his paint with.
Yeah, I feel like he might have worked as well a little bit with his left hand.
Hmm.
I think, I mean, his was definitely, you know, there was no paintbrush touching the canvas with him. It was all that dribbling. So I don't know. I'm trying to think about photos that I've seen of him.
Yes.
But yeah, a lot of the abstract painters that I studied when I was at TAFE, I studied a lot of those 50s American painters.
Yeah, all right.
And they all worked on unstretched. And Basquiat as well. I've always been drawn to that.
The Pollock photographs I've seen with him, with it stretched
rolls it all out
in Long Island or somewhere.
Yeah.
And you're working on, if you're right-handed, on the other hemisphere.
Yeah, it's more about shocking yourself with your mark, because I don't want to make predictable work. I think it's with my right, my right hand is what paints the birds and is accurate, whereas the left hand, it reacts, because those muscles aren't trained. It doesn't have the smoothness of curve, and there's an unpredictability to the brush strokes, which feels exciting, whereas the right, it's like you know it. You can see it and it's abstract, but it's
predictable.
Like, it feels tame. Yeah. Mm. So I wanted to do that. And it came about through painting with my little boy when he was, must have been, I don't know, 18 months old. I had to really wait. He's a little boy, so he's got a very short attention span. But I'd put big drop sheets out in the backyard and have big ripped up pieces of canvas. And we would work on those together. And then I would always work with my left hand because I wanted to mimic his kind of naivety with his work, his marks. So, and then I started bringing that process into my studio. So that was like two and a bit years ago now that I started this kind of journey.
Yeah. Quite coincidentally, I'm looking across your studio at a very small piece.
Yeah.
In old imperial measures, about 2 feet by 1.5. And it's got some interesting marks on it.
Yeah, so that's kind of a marriage between the mark making that I've been doing and the coral studies that I've been working on. So I started I'm trying to marry the two in the middle. I mean, that's what my birds and my animals have always been semi-abstracted, in that there is that richness of mark in there, but then there's the accuracy that comes in over the top to be able to identify it. So I'm trying to play with that middle ground as to how much to abstract and then how much to bring in over the top to develop recognition as a figurative thing. And reefs work quite well with that, because it is almost like a abstract mess under water, and there's a few things that bring it together to make you go, oh, that's a reef, but so much of it can just be splotches.
And for those who are not as informed, when they come into the gallery and are faced with all of this art, I mean, it's just lovely to look at. I've been privileged to look at it going up today.
Okay.
And there's some lovely colours there. There's some down one far end, which I think you said might have been from an earlier part of the couple of years you've taken, which do indeed have a coral look to them. I don't know if they're...
Also a Sydney Opera House vibe,
those
two. For some reason they feel very...
Brett Whiteley.
Yeah, there's kind of a Ken Doan, Brett Whiteley vibe.
Oh, I see that now. So there's going to be, in a sense, a profusion of colour. There's going to be marks that will make you stop and wonder and think what's going on there. Are there any clues, like a tour guide might give you when you climb the cathedral in Seville, as to what things might mean or what you should be looking for?
Someone said to me when I said, oh, it's all based on motherhood and the challenges and difficulties. And they said, but how do you read that in the work? And I was like, well, it's abstraction. So the best way I can describe it is that motherhood can be a frustrating area. As an artist, I'm not a structured person, and motherhood is very structured. So even just when I had my baby, I was like, well, I have to keep a feeding schedule. I have to know when he's fed, so I was never good at that idea of like, oh, I need to know exactly that it's been 3 hours and then he sleeps at these times. And that kind of was like, this is like really kind of responsible, which is always something I've gone away from because I want to remain a child. And that's the difficult thing as a parent. You have to play the role of the parent, and that often ends up as a lot of your time as a mother, and you don't get to play the role of the child. You create very safe situations and safe homes and environments for your kids to feel safe and grounded. And as an artist, you crave risk-taking and you crave bold moves, and you can't find that at home. And there is spontaneity, but your kids are the ones that are being spontaneous often. So it's that role thing of like, I feel like some of my magic is going because I have to be so responsible all the time. And I have to, sometimes I don't want to go to the park and play with my, you know, like that's not the kind of play I want.
So the paintings in some ways can be seen as a reaction to being regimented.
That's exactly what it is. And I think my normal process and practice, there are parameters in that that I have stuck to, just the act of having a source material image of a bird that I am then painting. That was still too regimented for me to find thrill in, and I felt like I was wanting to rebel against just having to paint something that looks like something.
Yes.
And I think in my mind I had worked up very much what people expect from me and my career and my brand, and so even just rebelling against that was thrilling.
This is Bob Dylan going electric.
Right, yeah. Well, any creative who gets known for anything and then you try and do something different, and even if it is not really what people are saying, the artist goes, well, I don't want to do that. I know you expect that of me. And I think it's almost just to have something to fight against and to rebel against, because the heart of creativity is rebellion.
We're getting to the point where we'll start to draw things to a close, but what I'm fascinated by, and we'll have to watch and find out, I suppose, rather than be able to get a ready answer from you, have you arrived then in this abstract place? What you've done in the past might be in the past, and what lies in the future?
Yeah, I don't know. I think I still, it's interesting because it depends on how I wake up that day. You know, sometimes I definitely do go in cycles where sometimes I feel absolutely fulfilled and happy to paint, you know, 10 owls and then put them online, because that is still a thing that I love. I love having a business and having a successful business and knowing things will sell. And there is definitely part of my personality that likes and needs that. So I definitely have days where I can't bear to paint certain things and I have to just paint on the floor abstract stuff. And then other days where I'm like, I don't feel like I've got that out of my system for a little while, and then I can paint. And I really want to, for me it is about picking when I can bring those challenges into my life, depending on what's happening with my kids and my family life and, you know, what time we wake up in the morning, whether it's 4:15 or 5:30. So I also like the challenge of seeing how far I can abstract my animals and still, you know, it still work for my brand. So there's lots of different areas that I feel like I can push. And which is the exciting thing, because I this abstraction definitely will become a big thing for my brand. It's going to take a while, I think, because people don't know me as an abstract painter, and I think I need to prove myself in that regard. But I do really want to paint massive, massive abstracts, you know, 3 meters by 2 meters, things like that.
Wonderful. So, and there's a couple of that sort of
Yeah, there's some 2 by 1.4s, which, yes. You know, when I was painting that in this studio, it's really kind of that's the space I have, which I just need to start getting rid of some of this stuff and I can clear out a bit more space. But even then, I was like, these are massive. And then you look at them in that space and they're big, but, you know,
you could
definitely go bigger. Because murals are like, I do love that scale and that size. And for me, abstraction is all about scale. It has to be expansive, and that's really what I want to start working on.
Well, people are going,
storage for that is going to be a nightmare, but we'll figure it out. Again, don't think about logistics.
No, people are going to love it, and I'm sure they'll encourage you to paint bigger. And is Fremantle a good place to be? Does this assist your creative juices and all of that?
Yeah, I think it's
What is it about Fremantle?
I mean, look, if we could bottle it, you know, I think it's the type of person that craves being, there is more self-expression just from the day-to-day looking at people walking around. And I think that is inspiring for people and exciting for people. I think the location being so next, you know, right next to such a beautiful beach, there's a laid back feel about Fremantle, but also I feel like there is, it feels exciting in that there is prospect here. So it's a, I don't know, there's a strange, whatever it is. I mean, the fact that I think, and like most really dynamic, exciting places, it was kind of, you know, developed and by artists because it was a dive. All the artists lived here because it was cheap. America's Cup happened and it became too hard for them to live here. You know, like they gentrified it and it has become gentrified. But like anywhere, Palm Springs, Brooklyn, all of the places that have that exciting feel. And I don't, I wonder if they will continue that forever or if gentrification will win over and that it loses its spirit completely. But
very interesting question.
Yeah, I think all places that were founded and developed by creatives are always going to feel exciting because there's always until, I mean, that's the thing, creatives will continually flock to those areas so they will remain exciting.
A topic for another day.
Yeah.
Well, it's been absolutely delightful talking
to
you,
nice.
Anya, and good luck with the exhibition.
Thank you.